Welcome to another episode of the Biographics Podcast. I am your host, Simon, and today, it starts with terrorism. Today we associate terrorism pretty much just, maybe a little less, as we'll see a little bit later on today, but it's kind of something we associate with the Middle East, Al-Qaeda, more recently ISIS, and kind of things like that, but that's only in relatively recent history, in the last maybe 20 years or so, pretty much since 2001, but not too long ago, kind of before then, that wasn't really the case. Indeed, the biggest terrorist attack in the United States before 9/11, and granted it was quite a bit smaller, but it was by an American, and an American citizen, and a born American. And you often think of terrorists today, at least I think a lot of people do, as they're not like you, they're different. They have kind of wild ideological beliefs that are so different from anything you know that, you know, they could, it's hard to wrap your head around a terrorist being someone from your own culture and your own background that could commit an atrocity against someone like you. But the reality is it's not really true, and that's only a relatively recent idea of terrorists and terrorism. And in today's podcast, we're going to be basically looking at someone who seemed to be a very ordinary American man who later became the deadliest American terrorist ever. In total, he killed 168 people. 19 of those were children. And if you haven't guessed it by now, it's the man responsible for the bombing was Timothy McVeigh. And we're going to look at how essentially he went from a decorated war veteran to basically, I wrote here, a regretless monster. So that's Timothy McVeigh. It's kind of a fascinating spiral how this man goes from something relatively ordinary to something relatively horrible. But as we always do, let's take it right back to the start. Let's take it back to Pendleton. It's a blue-collar community, just like many others in the United States. Nothing particularly remarkable about it before McVeigh, and even today, you know, obviously there's not really any mention there that it's where McVeigh comes from, possibly what they're most infamous for now. It's kind of just your everyday average place. Timothy McVeigh, he was born there April of 1968. He's a middle child, fairly normal family, nothing particularly unusual or special. His father was hardworking. His mother also hardworking. His mother's name was Mickey. She often spent time on the road, away from home. McVeigh, he had two sisters, older sister, younger sister, and they all kind of had the same statements afterwards, that they never really saw their parents very much growing up. Mother was out of town. Father was often working. Their backgrounds, Irish Catholic. They went to church, so they were a part of a community. Even though their parents were often away, they had people around them, people to help out, and that sort of thing. So his mother, unfortunately, had several affairs, and eventually she decided to leave McVeigh's father, and she took the daughters, he took the son. So Timothy McVeigh left with his dad, and basically he was kind of just left even more alone than before. His dad would just go off working endless shifts, and he'd kind of just be hanging out at home and at school and that sort of thing. Now, he was intelligent. He was shy. He was not well understood, as you can imagine from this kind of description. He was bullied at school. And already, maybe, we kind of see this, sadly, not an unusual situation, kind of absent parents, bullied at school. But maybe we're beginning to see a picture forming. Not exactly a recipe for happiness here, the absent parents and all of that stuff. I mean, definitely, I don't want to make any excuses or anything like that, but you can begin to see where, you know, this kind of man who commits this atrocity, you know, how he's kind of damaged as a youth and all of that stuff. Obviously, no excuse. The one person he did have a connection with, though, was his grandfather. They would go out shooting together, and that was a rare escape that McVeigh enjoyed. And we'll skip ahead a few years here. We'll go to his teenage years. And this was when we kind of first get the inklings of something actually problematic starting. out. It was in as a teenager, he started to become a little bit paranoid. And his paranoia was based around guns and shooting. So he would go shooting with his granddad. It was kind of his escape from his fairly solitary and kind of miserable childhood. And this was the one thing he enjoyed. And he basically started to worry that, hey, if I don't go shooting with my granddad, that's the only thing I enjoy. And I'm basically worried that the government are going to take away the guns and that would end the one fun thing I have. There's also another bit of radical or kind of radical exposure that happens in his teenage years. You've got this paranoia, and then you've also got the radical element of him. He reads this book, and this book, it's a weird, weird book called The Turner Diaries. And basically, and by weird I mean truly horrible, it's written by a neo-Nazi called William Luther Pierce in 1978. It's a fictional book, and it basically says, in the book, it says, hey, the blacks and the Jews are controlling America, and in the book, the whites rise up against them, and they conduct what is described in the book as a justified genocide. I think that's the only time I've seen those two words pushed together as one phrase, justified genocide. But essentially, that's what happens in the Turner Diaries. I was thinking for this podcast, we didn't really go into it in the video for this, for Timothy McVeigh. But I was thinking, I'll pull some quotes from here just to illustrate how nasty this book is. But I gotta say, kind of did some Googling. I didn't really want to. It's pretty rough stuff. I feel I was better off before reading it. You're probably better off not hearing it. Don't Google this one. It's not worth it. It's just really weird and nasty, and it's just bad. It's just like a propaganda piece or whatever. Anyway, so this is important. McVeigh, he reads this book, and it sounds kind of perfect for someone like him. He's paranoid. He's an outcast, and you know, often in that situation, you want someone to blame. It's not like, I'm at fault here, I'm an outcast, so it's on me, or I'm paranoid, it's on me. It's time to find someone to blame. And the Turner Diaries and the neo-Nazi author Pierce, he's kind of like, you know, it's the blacks, it's the Jews. And McVeigh's like, all right, I guess it's the blacks and the Jews, that's why I'm not happy, let's blame someone. So there's another kind of bad aspect of this book, is it has inspired, like, there's, on its Wikipedia page, there's a whole list of real world things, you know, real horrible events that this has inspired, McVeigh's of which is the biggest. And this book, it wasn't just an ideology for McVeigh. It's kind of, in the book, a truck bomb is detonated outside an FBI building, which kills 800 people. And if you're at all familiar with the Oklahoma City bombing, you'll definitely see some familiarities there. It's a government building, not quite 800, definitely not 800 people killed, but you know, still a horrific attack. Anyway, we'll get to that. But McVeigh basically kind of felt that this book was speaking to him. The people in the book had the paranoia, and he it just made him even more intense into this Second Amendment fighting survivalist type thing that he had going on. And he's 14 years old. I mean, we've all been teenagers. Well, personally, I didn't read any neo-Nazi books and get into, like, Second Amendment things, but why would I? You know, but we've all had kind of, or many of us, you know, at some point during your teenage years, you think, you know, screw the establishment, blah, 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 and all of this. And, you know, this could have been nothing more than that for McVeigh. He could have grown out of it. He could have graduated. He could have gone on and lived his life. But damn it, McVeigh, you had to kind of carry on through and get really into this and not continue living a normal life and getting past your teenage angst. So he ends up dropping out of school and joining the army. And this is kind of stage two of McVeigh's life. Now, the army seems to be kind of a first place he really starts to fit in. School hadn't been kind. He goes to the army, he completes boot camp, he makes friends. And one of these guys in particular, he's important to our story today, his name was Terry Nichols. He was also really into guns. But before we find out how Nichols fits into this tale, we need to head off to the Arabian Desert. The year is 1990. Saddam Hussein rolls into Kuwait. This is not a good time in Kuwaiti history. People are tortured, people are abducted, they're tortured, they're killed. 100,000 people end up fleeing the country. And basically, George Bush Senior, he orders the US Army to cross the border and go into Kuwait and deal with this stuff. And as you might have guessed, McVeigh, he's along with them. Indeed, he's at this point a special gunner, and he is at the head of a column that is rolling into Kuwait in 1991. He is seeing the fighting firsthand, and indeed, he fires one of the earliest shots of this invasion. And this is actually described later. He says that it entirely blew an Iraqi soldier's head right off his body. And, you know, bear in mind, you know, you hear a lot of these stories, and we certainly have a lot of people on this channel who are, they're just psychopaths. They'd blow it off and they'd enjoy it, or this kind of thing, or just possibly just feel nothing. McVeigh wrote later that this event really haunted him. He's not a psychopath. I'm not a psychological expert or anything, but he's paranoid. You know, that's what's driving him. It's non-reality rather than psychopathy. Anyway, so McVeigh also seems to feel a genuine horror about what's happening in Kuwait. And he said later, you know, because as we'll find out, he was sitting in prison for a while, and he had time to think about all this stuff, and biographers even, you know, detailed his life. He said that in Kuwait, something inside him died. His empathy seemed to disappear, and that would be something that never came back. So maybe he's drifting a little bit towards, you know, being a psychopath here. Anyway, he returns from the desert back to America, and it's at this point that he tries out for the special forces, but he doesn't succeed. He flunks out of whatever you call it. There's movies about this. I think I've seen the one with the SEALs where they're like in the sea and they're doing all this crazy stuff, and there's the bell they ring when they leave. I'm sure the qualification for special forces is extremely intense. Anyway, he's basically burned out, and it doesn't, you know, this seems to be the reason why he doesn't get in. Anyway, with that, he kind of just goes home. He returns to Pendleton. Not much is happening. He is seemingly quite significantly traumatized from the war. He doesn't have a proper support network. He can't find any steady work, and he kind of needs something. He needs to return to something he knows and something he loves, and instead of being a family, or as we said, a support network, he turns to his love of guns. So basically, our recipe is, you know, coming together. We've got Vey. He's troubled, but not terrible. He's got a troubled but not terrible childhood, got a dusting of paranoia, love of the Second Amendment, and then the Gulf War causing that psychological damage. It's time to add another ingredient, more fanatics, what we'd call an echo chamber today, if you will. And his echo chamber, this was the gun show circuit. This was sort of interesting. I didn't really know much about the gun show circuit in the United States. I think I'd seen a few things about, you know, how gun sales work and, you know, watch some videos on YouTube and stuff like that. But I didn't really know much about it. And basically, it's a group of people who travel around the United States selling guns. They sort of live this semi-nomadic lifestyle. And McVeigh, he was like, you guys have guns. I love guns. I'll join you guys. But he wasn't selling guns. At these gun shows, he would sell copies of the Turner Diaries, the neo-Nazi book that we mentioned. And apparently, this was totally cool with the people who were there. I don't know. You don't want to lump too many people together. I'm sure there's lots of people who like guns who don't like the Turner Diaries. But apparently, this was okay. He could sell these books at this event, and I guess. I'm not sure about this, but I don't think that book in the UK would be allowed because it would be kind of hate speech or something. I'm not sure. Free speech is a much bigger thing, I think, in the US. If someone knows about that, like, is this book, can you buy this book in the US? Is that allowed? Can you have hate speech? Just drop me an email. I don't actually have an email for this podcast yet, but, oh no, I do. You could use my biographics email, simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email, and yeah, maybe I can bring that up in a future episode. Anyway, this anti-gun crowd, this pro-gun crowd are anti-government. So, you know, I guess they're kind of they're McVeigh's crowd. Anyway, do you remember the guy Nichols, his buddy who he met in the army, you know, his kind of first friend, guy he resonated with? This is where he re-enters the picture. Now, we don't really know how they got back in touch, so I'm just going to assume maybe they connected through Facebook. No, they didn't really. This was way before Facebook. So they got together, and basically they were like, hey, you know, I'm selling the Turner Diaries. Nichols, do you want to join me and we can sell army surplus? And so they're doing that, and they're kind of doing the whole like echo chamber thing. Hey man, you know what sucks? Yeah, the government sucks. Screw the government. Screw those guys. Whatever. And you know, this is all fun and games until things get really, really real. And there are a couple of inciting incidents here, a couple of things that really seem to kick things off for these guys. First of them is something called Ruby Ridge. I hadn't actually heard of this before we did this, did the episode on the YouTube channel about this. It's pretty intense. Basically, there's this dude called Randy Weaver. He's a former army man, a Green Beret, and basically he's kind of a survivalist. So he goes off with his wife and children. He takes his wife and children off and they go live in a cabin overlooking a place called Ruby Creek. So they kind of leave society behind. And basically, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, the ATF, they want him to become an informer because he's definitely involved in some like dodgy criminal circles or something. And it turns out they definitely did have something on him because they wanted, like I said, they wanted him to become an informer. I guess they were kind of blackmailing him because they had, well, leveraging. I don't know what it's called when it's kind of legal, but it's like they had some leverage. I guess they were negotiating some sort of, hey, you can get off if you kind of inform on these people. He didn't inform, and so they come after him, they indict him, and he is supposed to go to court in 1991. That court date, it basically rolls around, and Nichols doesn't show up, so an arrest warrant goes out for him, and so the cops, he's living out in the wilderness, kind of. He's off the grid, and it takes the cops about a year to find his cabin. Finally, that year later, they move in. And now this is a time before there were body cams and anything like that. So the details about the raid are actually pretty blurry. We don't have a ton of information. But what we do know is that an officer approaches the cabin, a dog starts barking, and also Randy's 14-year-old son, he comes out of the cabin with a gun in his hand. Then there's kind of blank tape, if you will, and then the next thing we know is the dog, the boy, and a deputy are all dead. And then the FBI just absolutely lays siege. And in the siege, Randy is shot. He runs away to get to safety. He is shot again, and he still survives. But unfortunately, a rogue bullet, not intended to hit anyone else but him, it hits his wife straight in the head, and she obviously dies instantly. Now, this had ramifications far beyond just this little incident in the woods, or little incident, major incident in the woods, because people in the gun show circuit, they're like these guys. They're the survivalists. They're people, you know, for the Second Amendment rights and guns and all of that stuff. They're checking all the boxes, and they really don't like this. This, and McVeigh and his buddy Nichols, they basically think, you know, this is proof. The government, if you've got guns, is going to come for you, and they're going to kill your family. We know he's a little bit paranoid. But then, one thing, then I said there were two inciting incidents. The second one is one you've almost certainly heard of, and that's Waco. This happens in 1993, basically a little less than a year after Ruby Ridge, and the ATF are there again. So we've actually done a biographics video on the YouTube channel about David Koresh, the leader of, or the Branch Davidians who were at Waco. If you want to learn more about that, definitely go check out that video. Might even do it as a podcast in the future as well. Anyway, David Koresh is the leader of the Branch Davidians. The ATF think that he's been having, which is kind of a cult sort of thing, and they think he's violating firearms regulations. So he's got a compound, they raid the compounds, and four agents die, and six of his followers, called the Davidians, are also dead. But this is not the end of the situation here, because next comes the big part of Waco, and that's the standoff. 51 days go by in this standoff. You've also got protests happening nearby, and McVeigh is one of the protesters. He's in the crowd. After 51 days, the FBI, they finally have had enough, and they decide to storm the compound. Now, as we talked about in the video on the channel, we go into much more detail about this, but basically at some point a fire starts and we still don't really know what caused that fire to start. What we do know is that afterwards 75 of the Davidians were dead and 25 of them were children. And basically McVeigh and Nichols, they see this and basically they see the same thing again. They think firearms offenses, huge and deadly action by the government, and this just stokes them up even further. And yeah, this was kind of it. That was the trigger. And it's kind of at that point that McVeigh and Nichols go from talking about how much they dislike the government to basically starting to make bombs. There is kind of another thing here. It comes a little bit later and it just kind of incites them even more. But, you know, they'd already started making bombs at this point, so we don't really know how far they'd have gone. But that was 1994. Bill Clinton is now president and he signs a weapons ban on certain firearms. And basically, it's just more fuel on the fire. McVeigh, pretty much, he actually later said that this was the last straw that led to the big bombing. Okay, so first of all, McVeigh's idea wasn't bombing at all. He wanted to actually be very specific. He wanted to assassinate people, basically targeting those that he felt were responsible for Ruby Ridge. And it kind of turned out that this was too hard. The politicians he felt were responsible, the kind of people in the government, they were just too well protected. There were guards. There was just too much of a chance of him failing and getting caught. And it was at this point that he got some inspiration from Islamic extremism. Now, 9/11, it wasn't the first time that Islamic extremists had tried to actually take down the World Trade Center. In 1993, they parked a truck with a bomb in it beneath the North Tower with the hope that the bomb would detonate and it would cause the entire North Tower to collapse. But it didn't succeed, obviously, and only 6 people died. So, yes, basically McVeigh, he liked that they had tried, he admired their boldness, but he didn't like the failure, and he knew that if he was doing something like that, he would do it better. But there was a bit of a hold-up, there was a bit of a problem. He was kind of making these small pipe bombs and stuff, he didn't have a lot of experience with explosives, and importantly, he didn't really have a lot of money. Now, the good news for McVeigh is that, and the bad news for everyone else, is that Nichols, he had both. He had knowledge of explosives, and he had money. Now, do you remember the Turner Diaries? Basically, McVeigh, he said to Terry, he said, "Hey, Terry, do you want to blow up a federal building like in the book?" To which Terry, apparently being a bit of a dick, he basically responded like, "Yeah, man, that sounds cool," or something like that. Now, you probably know that a bomb can be made from fertilizer. I think it's fertilizer and fuel. I think diesel. So you use like an ammonium nitrate fertilizer and diesel. I remember this from a fiction book I read when I was a kid. Then they built like a giant bomb from this. They were the good guys, though. They were like fighting back against some invading army or something. It was a cool book. I can't for the life of me remember what it's called, but I was surprised about that. Anyway, this is what they thought they would make their bomb from. So they began getting a lot of fertilizer together, and they were also testing out the pipe bombs. So McVeigh, he also made contact with someone who could sell them racing fuel. And I'm assuming racing fuel is a better accelerant here than diesel, so it would be a more effective bomb. Anyway, so McVeigh has to go down and pick up this fuel in Dallas. And on the way, he stops at Oklahoma. As we know, the final bombing occurred in Oklahoma City. Now, we don't know for sure that this is the point where he picks the Alfred P. Murrah building to be his target. Some think that he actually only selected it on the very day of the bombing, but according to FBI reports later, they said on this trip down to Dallas, he stopped outside of the building. Now, McVeigh said that he had originally chosen a different federal building, but he saw that there was a flower store inside, so he basically ended up changing his mind and taking it to the Alfred P. Murrah building, which is the one he finally bombed. He apparently didn't feel the same way about the daycare center in the building as he felt about the flower shop. He felt that was something that was okay to bomb. Very unusual. So, but this isn't, you know, he's still a ways off. And a few months go by, he's still getting fertilizer, he's still going to gun shows, he's kind of just living his normal weird life. But at this point, he needs more fertilizer. Nichols has money, but not a ton of money. And so he starts stealing and selling guns illegally. Obviously, illegally stealing them and selling them. to get more fertilizer. Now, 1995 rolls around, and by this point, things, they've kind of got a bit weird. His, like, normal weird life has gone to just straight-up weird life. He cuts himself off even from Nichols. He starts taking some pretty intense drugs. He's on crystal meth and acid, and he just starts sleeping in his car or in motels, just completely nomadic, on-the-road life. He's also got an old friend from the army who hooks him up with a fake ID, which he is using to rent vehicles. This will be an important part later in the story. Now, we don't actually know much about the last few weeks of his life, but we do know that on Easter Sunday of 1995, he does go to Kansas. And on April the 18th, he and Nichols, who he's got back together with, they mix the bomb together. And that same day, Easter Sunday, he leaves with the bomb. Now, this is the big day, April the 19th, 1995. North of Oklahoma City that day, a police officer, he pulls over a driver because he doesn't have a license plate. Now, that police officer, he'd heard over the radio that there was an explosion in Oklahoma City, and many people, many officers were turning around to head to the disaster. But this policeman, his name was Charlie Hanger, he was a very by-the-books guy, so he pulls over the car, and he notices that the driver has a bulge under his jacket, which was an illegal concealed weapon. He arrests the man, and Charlie never, I mean, why would you think it? He never realizes that this man in the car is about to become very much more wanted for a much more major crime. So the bomb, it had gone off at 9:02 a.m. and the destruction, it was truly massive. The bomb in front of the building, it destroyed, and the pictures of this, I don't know, I wasn't really, in 1997, I was 10 years old. No, when was this? 1995, I was 7-8 years old. I don't really have any memory of this actually happening, but the pictures, like, wow, it's super intense and all of this stuff. There's no images of it, there's no video of it actually going off that I could find, kind of day before everything being filmed. Anyway, this bomb goes off and 8 floors of the building collapse. Windows 25 miles away are shaking from the blast, and 168 people have been killed. Now, at first, kind of, the news media was saying, this can't possibly have been an individual. It's too great. It's too much. It's too great a bomb. It's got to be an action by a foreign power. People even started suggesting that Saddam Hussein was behind the attack. But no one knew that in the courthouse in the town of Perry, just north, close to where he got arrested in that car, McVeigh's already in jail. He was arrested for that lack of license plate, that concealed weapon. Kind of, this seemed a bit bizarre. Like, if you're fleeing a fairly major crime and you don't have a license plate on your car, I don't know, that seems pretty dumb. Like, you're asking to get pulled over, aren't you? And that's going to be a big problem. But still, no one knows this. 2 days go by, and McVeigh is ready to go and post bail. He goes to see the judge, and you can bet, like, he would just go on the run. And that's it. Fortunately, the FBI call that police station just in time and essentially just say, do not let him go. Whatever you do, do not let him go. So you might be wondering now, well, how did they catch him? Amazingly, the axle of the truck, which he had rented to put the bomb in, had survived the blast, and it was thrown 2 blocks from the explosion. Now, police officers, they found this axle, and they found a serial number on it, and they traced it back to a motel where McVeigh was staying under his real name. Again, that seems pretty dumb. If you're committing a big, major crime, this was months, years in the thinking, and he just makes these pretty dumb mistakes, it seems. Anyway, that was it. They knew it was him. They go there. You know, he's stuck in prison. And then at that courthouse, when he's going there, huge mob forms. People start chanting baby killer. Like I said, 19 children killed in the explosion at their daycare center. And at this point, McVeigh is standing outside of the courthouse, and he's just looking around at the rooftops, looking, and he later said that he was expecting to be shot by a sniper at that point, and he was pretty concerned, because in kind of his deluded way, he he wanted to survive so he could get to court and he could explain his logic. He could explain why he had done the bombing, and then people would come around. They would begin to see that the government was repressing them, and they'd understand why he'd killed 19 children and 168 people overall. And the reason he thinks this is because that's what happened in the Turner Diaries. But life, it's not fiction. It's especially not neo-Nazi crazy fiction. Instead of people coming around and seeing his point of view, he was indicted, everyone hated him, and he was sentenced to death. Yay! Nichols, his pal, he escaped the death penalty narrowly, getting 161 life sentences with zero possibility of parole. Nichols is still in prison to this very day. And just to illustrate quite how much McVeigh was wrong, just how deluded he was, just how it just seems so crazy. People will come around, they'll realize why I did it. This is how it's going to be. You idiot. Just to illustrate how much people hated him, Oklahomans, they paid for the jury on the case to come and have a VIP tour of Oklahoma. And also, another thing, when he was executed by lethal injection, so many people wanted to go and watch it that they had a lottery for tickets to go and do it. Kind of morbid, also kind of like, I don't really know where I fall on the death penalty. We don't have it in the UK, so it's never really something I thought a great deal about. Kind of like with this, being like, I don't know. Kind of seems like he should die, I guess. I don't know, I'm sure there's really strong arguments against that as well, but yeah, anyway. So, he was finally executed in July of 2001. But what else happened? Well, we know that he never showed any remorse. The way he described the children that he killed was collateral damage. He basically stuck by his guns the entire time, saying that it was a justified response to Waco. And bizarrely, Gore Vidal, the famous author, he kind of agreed with him, which seems pretty messed up to me. Some people did agree with him. I imagine his old gun circuit buddies did. Anyway, at this point in American history, it wasn't Islamic terrorism that most people were worried about. It was right-wing terror. This sort of thing. That was the specter in the United States. But exactly 2 months after his execution, 9/11 happens, and pretty much everyone's perspective shifted away from that. But today, you know, it's definitely not forgotten. No way at all. It still holds its place as the most deadly domestic terrorist of all time. But, you know, nowadays people are vying for the title. That's Dylan Roof, Robert Bowers, certainly new monsters in McVeigh's shadow. So that's Timothy McVeigh, a darker one today. Next up, we've got Hugh Hefner. So that should be a little bit more fun. This was morbid and depressing. Killing children, never really a fun time. But hopefully illuminating, and hopefully a little look into right-wing terror, which seems a little more, like I say, a little more prevalent than it was over the last 20 years. Anyway, I will see you on the next episode. As always, please do leave us a review. Drop me an email, simon@biographics.org, with any questions or comments or anything like that. Leave us a review, all of that good stuff. And I'll be back in the next episode.